Welcome on to a Monday night edition of the Dunked on Basketball podcast. Danny and I just got back from Oracle. We witnessed yet another Golden State demolition tonight, in which they set the record for largest margin of victory over the first four games of a season, 100 points. Danny, the team continues to get more ridiculous.
It does, and tonight felt different to me because, yes, this Memphis team has struggled a lot, and, you know, they had that game against the Cavs, which was distinctly not great, but the Warriors, after a first quarter where they actually trailed at the end of it, 22-21, I believe, they just, for two quarters, completely demolished a talented Grizzlies team that we both think is a pretty confident playoff team.
Yeah, I agree with that. Even in that first quarter, the Grizzlies were even lucky to get to 22 points. Even the buckets that they were getting were at the end of the shot clock. And even when they were getting the few buckets they did get in the second and third quarters, it was, you know, they probably five or six of those were in the last 3 seconds of the shot clock, which is pretty ridiculous. The Grizz had kind of righted the ship by beating the Nets at home in a pretty, you know, average victory. They had a nice win on the road against the Pacers, so they came in 2-1, and this was just, I mean, it was a 50-point blow. It's only, what, like the eighth or ninth or something? I forget exactly what you researched, 50-point blowout, including the playoffs, in the last, like, 20 years?
I think it was the 11th of this millennium, and it's the 25th since the three-point line in 79.
Wow. Okay. It's good to... good to be there for amazing history like this. So let's get into this game a little bit. I mean, it's obviously it's going to be kind of a Warriors love fest after a game like this. We mentioned the scoring margin through four games. The Draymond Green nearly out-assisted the Grizzlies over those second and third quarters, 7-6. They only had one more assist. Memphis had 27 points in the second and third combined on 18.8% shooting, 0 of 9 from 3, and Curry had 21 just in the third. So it was really, and the Warriors had 24 fast break points in those quarters, and the Grizzlies had 27 points all told in those quarters.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those games where you could pull out a ton of them. The other kind of quirky one that I really liked was that Memphis shot identical 13 of 48 from on contested and uncontested shots, which is the first time in all the times that I've looked at it that I've ever seen a team have an identical split and shoot exactly the same.
Yeah, and be exactly that bad.
That bad on both. Yeah, I mean, that makes it a lot crazier. But yeah, I mean, and I think we can talk about the stats, but I think the real takeaway from this game and the rest of the season is that Stephen Curry is the best player in the league right now.
Yeah, I think so. I wrote as much. I felt like last March, I felt like I was going out on a limb at that point, being a little bit predictive. At that point, it was looking like he was going to win the MVP, and I thought that not only his individual stats, but just the effect that he has on the team were pretty huge. But I said, basically, he didn't have as good a year. No one had as good a year in 2015 as either James or Durant had in 2014. I was basing it on the fact that James declined. Despite the fact that everyone loved what James did in the playoffs, I actually think the playoffs kind of confirmed to me that he had declined a little bit. I mean, he shot over 50% in precisely one game in the entire playoff run. And, you know, Steph Curry had the best regular season last year. I think pretty much everyone would agree with that. I think he had the best overall playoffs last year. If you really look at the statistics and what his team was able to do offensively and the fact that they weren't challenged. And now he has had by far the best start to this year, 30 points in, 28 minutes. And he's now, he did it on 17 shooting possessions. His efficiency has been unbelievable. The team efficiency has been unbelievable. They have a 115 offensive rating, which is 5 points better than the best in the league last year, obviously only through four games. But this is four games against what looked like a very difficult slate, the three teams that they beat in the Western Conference playoffs last year.
And it does get a little bit of an adjustment just because the Pelicans have been so hurt. But the way that...
Well, I mean, are they really that hurt in that second game? I mean, Drew
The second game, you're right. I mean, but in the first game, it was Ish Smith just off the heap and Nate Robinson, who they've already cut.
Yeah. The first game, maybe I think you're right about that. But yeah, I mean, it's just Curry is the best player in the league until further notice. I am now thoroughly convinced of that. And unless someone else, like, you know, is going to have to snatch that crown from him, as far as I'm concerned right now.
So would you agree? I think it's hard to argue at this point that anybody else is the best offensive player in the league.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true.
So then really what you have to argue is that somebody else is so much better than he is on defense that it negates the offensive advantage. And that isn't impossible. You know, he isn't a dominant defensive player. You know, when you think about like prime LeBron, who could do it on both ends, or, you know, some of those players. But he's such an important part of this team, which has been, you know, they were the second best team in offensive efficiency last year. They're right now, they're tops in the league this year. And Curry, while point guard defense, I think, is somewhat overrated, he, tonight, you talked about this during the game, actually, he is a really strong team defender for his position. While it's not the most important, he can be underappreciated on that end.
Yeah, well, Memphis allowed that to shine today with the fact that he was able to get in the passing lanes, use his quick hands for steal. They put Klay Thompson on Mike Conley. I liked that Luke Walton just decided to just go and win the game right away. He didn't mess around with putting Klay on Courtney Lee and putting Steph on Mike Conley like he did, or not he, but like the Warriors did to start that series last year in game two. And I thought a big part of why they finally were able to start locking Memphis down is because Klay did a great job on Conley. He did that again tonight. They did not go with the center guard Tony Allen, and it worked just fine. Tony Allen basically played, the first like 5 minutes of each half, and he got four chances in that third quarter to start, where he tried to cut along the baseline and just got completely swallowed up by the health defense. He missed a couple of corner threes. What do you make of Memphis at this point? Can we just throw this game out? I mean, they did shoot terribly. They got some open shots that they missed. I'm starting to think, though, that the Warriors are just a really, really bad matchup for them as well, which is ironic because 2 years ago we were talking about the exact opposite in this relationship.
I think the Warriors are a bad matchup for them, but when you think about the two absolute offensive stinkers that they've put out there already against two teams that have been good on defense, one surprisingly so in Cleveland and the Warriors, you have to take a little bit from that, but I still think they're a great regular season team, and the reason that they play really hard, they have a lot of talent that most teams have trouble countering. And one thing that I thought was fascinating about this game, and we saw a little bit of this in the playoffs, was that for stretches of time, the Warriors were having Draymond on Marc Gasol and Festus Ezeli on Zach Randolph. And I think that there's definitely something to that, which some teams match. And I'm very intrigued.
Yeah, that's usually how most teams do it. Yeah. Most teams will put the center on Zach Randolph.
Yeah, and we'll see what Utah does, because Utah, I think, is a team that has, you know, close to the physical thing, and they play, I think, on the weekend. I think it's Saturday. And I'm intrigued to see what Quinn Snyder does, if he follows that idea, or if he goes the other way.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like Memphis versus New Memphis, those two teams in some ways.
Except that I think Utah has more offensive potential long term.
Yeah, that's probably true. But yeah, I think the biggest reason that I consider the Grizzlies now such a bad matchup for Golden State is that Golden State is just beating Zach Randolph. He was 2 out of 9 in this game. Ezeli was able to guard him one-on-one just fine. Gasol wasn't able to beat up on Green either. He was 5 out of 12. And then Zach Randolph just gets killed at the other end. He doesn't get back quick enough in transition. Curry just runs a pick and roll with him every time, and it's a good shot every single time. And then if the Warriors want to go small and D. West to guard Barnes, he can't do that either. It's really, it's getting to the point where you wonder whether he and Tony Allen, the two guys who I think really have defined the style of Grizzlies basketball, if not been their best players over these last few years, if those guys can stay on the floor against the Warriors.
And something that struck me in this game, though it's been true for a while, is how hard it is to come back against the best lineups that the Warriors play. You can do it against their backups. Their backups, you know, they have limitations in terms of shooting and all that. But a team that is great defensively and that at this point has a much better, is also great in transition and is doing a lot better job, I think, of maximizing their looks in half court, it's really hard to come back on them because you have to get a series of stops and you have to make shots consistently. And so I'm getting to the point, you know, they've always said, there was the thing last year about how when the Warriors got up 20, I think it was 20, right? Not 15 that they,
15
that they didn't lose.
They were like 60-0 or something like that.
But I feel like now it's getting closer to 10. I mean, obviously there's variance within a game and it's not like, oh, you close, salt off the game when it's a 10, but I'm appreciating more how hard it is to come back against their best lineups.
All right, should we move on here? Let's get to some news before we talk about the Oklahoma City-Houston game. Cody Zeller apparently missed practice, according to beat writer Rick Bonnell. He has lost 10 pounds unexpectedly and is having tests. We haven't heard anything about that yet. Not much else to say on that until we find out more, but something for people to be aware of. Other injury-related news we talked about, DeMarcus Cousins' Achilles injury. He will now miss the next two games to rest his strained right Achilles. The Kings are 1-2. Hard to say that they're favorites against a lot of teams, really. Who do they play over those next two? Do you know?
I do not know, but I believe their third game is against the Warriors.
Let's see. Yeah, and just because he's out those two. Yeah, so they play the Grizzlies, actually, tomorrow night.
That's right.
And then they are... have a back-to-back against the Suns. And then they have a homestand Friday and Saturday against the Rockets and Warriors. And then they play the Spurs after that at home. So that's a nice 3 games in 4 days at home against the Rockets, Warriors, and Spurs. West schedule can be brutal at times. But, yeah, they need Cousins back because if they don't have him for this stretch, that could easily turn into 1-5, 1-6. And they have a lot of games in a lot of days. I mean, that's 4 and 5 nights, right? Yeah, 4 and 5 nights. Bad time for him to come down with this. And then they have another 2 in the next 4 days after that.
Yeah, it's tough for them, and it'll be a test. We talked a little bit in the offseason about how they kind of built a team that could, you know, it didn't always make sense with Cousins just because they added so many centers. And I'm intrigued to see how Kufos in particular does if they kind of use him more as the five, and then have, I don't know who they'll play, what they'll do with the four, whether they'll use
Kim. I think it's going to be more Rudy Gay at the four, Caspi at the four. I do like that. I think they can have some success playing that way. I'm also very interested to see what Cauley-Stein can do as a center with some of those, a small lineup around him, especially with his ability to switch out. And also, kind of be a dunker in the pick and roll. So I will be interested to watch those games and kind of see what they look like without Cousins. But they do really need him. Jabari Parker.
Yep.
Good news. Cleared to play. The Bucks have announced on Wednesday against Philly. Tyler Ennis will also be back from his shoulder injury. I would not expect him to be in the rotation. But I'll be watching Jabari closely. I loved him last year. He was number one on my board last year. And... we'll see. I mean, it's obviously going to take him some time to work back. I mean, he looks about the same from a body composition standpoint. I saw some video of him working out today. So that's good. I'm glad that he's back. It was starting to get a little odd that he had not yet returned.
And also the fact that they can replace minutes from clearly inferior players with Jabari Parker minutes will be huge for the Bucks. They've been a little bit disappointing so far, but a lot of that is they had Giannis was suspended and Parker was out. So I think that this will help them get on the right track.
Yeah, and they beat the Nets tonight.
Yeah, they did. Ooh. In a close game, a game that came down to the wire in some kind of weird plays, but it was fun to catch the end of that game.
So let's move on to OKC Houston. OKC looks like they're totally on track. Houston had not been. Houston ended up winning this game. Russ Westbrook got into foul trouble, picking up his fourth, going after an offensive rebound, and then he missed the entire third quarter. Donovan brought him back, but by that point, the damage had been done. They were up by 14 when he left, and it was pretty much tied when he returned. But I had some more takeaways from this besides just, oh, they lost because Westbrook was in foul trouble. And my number one takeaway is this looks like the exact same team as it did under Scott Brooks to me.
That's I haven't watched, admittedly, a ton of them. Sadly, I missed most of the awesome game against the Magic. But what makes you think that they're, you know, like, it's hard to say what's the same, but what's the same?
17 assists on 40 made field goals tonight. In crunch time, let's see. Let me run through some of their possessions in crunch time. They had one pass possession that occurred with 5 seconds on the shot clock with 3:30 remaining. The next possession, they had one pass that occurred with 8 seconds on the shot clock. The next play was a pass to Durant, who got fouled at the free throw line, one pass possession. The next possession was zero passes, in which KD missed a drive other than the inbounds pass from the sideline. And then the next possession was zero passes as well. It was Russ with a three in transition, which was actually a good shot. So that was like their last six possessions of the game. And they didn't really do particularly well on those against Oklahoma City. As we noted on Sunday's program, it was kind of the same thing. Russ and KD one-on-one creating everything. And that's fine if those guys are taking all the shots, but there's no ball movement still. There's no side-to-side movement at all. Granted, Houston's defense was switching a lot. They went with a really small lineup. With the reset at the four, they played Marcus Thornton 37 minutes. So he actually was pretty good in this game. But so that switching is always going to take away your number of assists because you're just forced to create one-on-one a little bit more. But they're just not moving the defense at all. It looks like it's pretty similar. And then defensively, they're 18th in the league so far, not having played some murderer's row of offenses either. They don't really look much improved, particularly on that side either.
You want to talk about our friend Dion Waiters?
Well, I mean, he had a couple of dumb reach-ins in the fourth quarter, and that was really the sum total of his contributions, because I don't believe he touched the ball other than just getting like an offensive rebound kickout, which he immediately passed to KD, and that was for that last desperation three attempt that KD missed off the backboard. So with under 10 seconds remaining. So if you're not going to ever pass Waiters the ball to create one-on-one, he's not really a great spot-up shooter. Why have him out there? You know, I mean, he's not really contributing so much more than like a Kyle Singler or an Anthony Morrow with his defense. You could say that at least he has to be guarded, unlike Roberson, who the Rockets just weren't guarding at all in the first half. But it was funny, right? Like, who is guarding James Harden in this game? Well, it had to be Kevin Durant, because they still don't have a two-way guy on the wing next to Kevin Durant, despite giving up two first-round picks last year. And this game put that in stark relief for me. And, you know, who are they going to have guard Klay Thompson? Is that going to be Durant too? You know, is Russ going to be on Curry in the clutch? It's they just don't have great matchups when KD is someone that you don't want guarding the other team's best player.
And they had a couple stretches, which in some ways was even crazier, that they had Kyle Singler on Harden, which just felt like a lamb being led to the slaughter to me.
Yeah, Singler did okay. I mean, he's at least, I like him at least because he's going to kind of not screw up and fall for Harden's trick.
That's true.
But yeah, it was interesting though, Houston's approach. We had talked about how Harrell and Capella were really the only bright spots on this team through the first week. I know Calvin Watkins, their ESPN beat writer, had tweeted that. Those guys combined for 15 minutes in this game, and they just decided they were going to go small with Ariza at the four. There are times when Harden was at the four, and they were playing with two point guards, Thornton and Harden. And Oklahoma City, until the last 3 minutes of the game, essentially matched up big with them, two bigs, Ibaka and either Cantor or Adams, pretty much the entire game.
Do we have to put out a search party for KJ McDaniels? Because it was just, I've been a fan of his for a while, and Thornton played well, but 37 minutes just felt like a ton for him, considering I guess KJ is probably their next best option for those minutes.
Yeah, it was Brewer getting really only three guys off the bench, Beverly, Brewer, and then, you know, Capella got a little bit of time, and Harrell got 5 minutes. So yeah, I don't know. I think just the coaching staff has decided that McDaniels isn't ready, either from an execution standpoint or a shooting standpoint. But you would think that with their starting power forwards, you know, Monty Unis and Jones both out, he could at least get some time to see what he can do since they've been kind of searching.
Do you want to unveil the new James Harden nickname?
Yeah, so My girlfriend, we were just sitting watching the game on Friday, the Warriors Houston game. And, you know, she sort of sees Harden, his foul drawing ability and stuff. And I just kind of explained, like, how that works to her because she didn't, until we started dating like 6 months ago, she never watched basketball at all. And so she had one of the best observations I've ever heard about Harden, which was essentially if he were not a basketball player, he'd be one of those guys who just tries to get cars to hit him so he could sue them. which I thought was like just one of like that's why I'm dating this girl, right? But and so then I tweeted that out, and then someone said, yeah, that's exactly what would happen on the show Better Call Saul. Slipping Jimmy was the name of the character who would do that, like those sort of scams to sue people. And so I think, you know, Jimmy James is pretty much the same thing. I think we got to start calling Harden Slipping Jimmy, especially when he gets into that mode at this point.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was really on point. I got really mad that a couple people got to it before I did. You haven't watched Better Call Saul, right?
No, I have. Yeah, I watched it.
Okay, good.
But I had forgotten about Slippin' Jimmy, sadly. But I will be using that now. I can't remember who it was who tweeted it to me. I'm sorry, I'm not giving.
I know Ethan did, but I'm not sure if Ethan was first. And I always want to give credit to the person who's first, so I can't say.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll be talking about that. Getting back to actual basketball analysis, there's another thing that I've been noting a lot, and I started seeing this with Kirk Heinrich in the playoffs last year, is I'm trying to come up with a name for it. I'm going to call it just a dead right now, which is basically a lot of times when you're on offense, you'll have one guy be able to create an advantage. Either he'll kick the ball to someone and they can run a pick and roll, or they'll have an open spot up shot, or they can drive a closeout and kind of keep the defense off balance. And I realized that there are certain guys, Heinrich being most prominent among them in last year's playoffs, where you throw it to them when they have an advantage and they don't shoot the shot, and then they can't drive and continue to keep the defense off balance. They basically give up the advantage that the other players have worked so hard to create and allow the defense to recover. Robertson is a guy who is a perfect example of this on Oklahoma City. If he's not going to just take his load up for an hour corner three, he's just not able to do anything with the ball. If you throw it to him, you can count on him wasting 5 seconds. They can guard him one-on-one. Everyone gets back to their man, and then someone else to go, like, run over to him, get the ball to him, because he doesn't even make quick decisions moving the ball either. He just kind of holds it and looks for something to do or someone to give it to. And now you're right back where you started again. And every time you throw them the ball, you're basically wasting like 5 seconds of the possession. It's really an amazing correlation that when you throw it to guys like that, how you're going to end up getting a tough shot in the late clock, because it just ends up kind of resetting everything. And with the 24-second shot clock, that kind of offensive play is really, really damaging.
Is Thabo a cut above those guys?
Oh, you know, I was noting that with him, and I think he's a little bit better, especially on the Hawks, too, just because they have the culture of moving the ball more quickly. But I do notice that a little bit with him as well. I mean, he's not going to be able to run a pick and roll and dribble handoff and really kind of keep the spacing train running and keep the ball movement train running, because he doesn't really have anyone to pass it to, right? Like, because you haven't created an opening and forced help and then created an obvious pass. So unless he can move the ball right away or shoot the ball right away, yeah, I think that he does kind of fall into that category.
I will also note, though, that we do not need to talk about the naming, that once Nate pitched this idea to me, I thought it was of an indulgence, because I can go to the religious history, those of you who know the term.
All right, so I don't understand why you wrote that at all. So an indulgence, my understanding of this from AP European History senior year of high school, is it's basically paying the Pope to forgive your sins and let you go to heaven just because you paid the church money.
So basically what an indulgence is in that sense is, I think of it, it's from the defensive perspective. So basically it's defensive salvation without having done anything right.
Yes, I get it. Okay.
And so that's the idea. The idea is that you were redeemed despite not doing anything to particularly do it. So that's, in the indulgence sense, it became a scandal because it was financial, but that's the logic of it for me.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just a possession killer would be like another way to look at it too. I don't know. Anybody has a better term for this? I mean, I think it's something we're going to.
But it's a good concept. I think that's the most important thing.
Good concept. Needs a name. All right. What else we got here? we got about 30 minutes in here. I think we can kind of bring in another kind of one of our regular features, and that is preseason predictions that we would like to revise. I'm sure that by the end of the season, we'll have gotten to nearly all of our preseason predictions. But even after three games, it may be time to look at some of them. Now, it'll be hilarious, of course, if it turns out to be an overreaction and we want to go back to our preseason predictions to begin with. But it's also worth noting that what we've seen so far doesn't necessarily mean nothing, especially if it is something where you feel like, all right, this lays into a worry that we might have had already with this team, or there's some reason, something about the performance so far that you believe is likely to continue, or simply in the case I'm about to talk about, where you just banked enough wins that it actually might make a difference. And so that's my first change in prediction. I had the Pacers as the 8th seed and the Pistons as the 9th seed. And I'm going to say that the Pistons are going to make the playoffs because the Pistons are 3-0 and the Pacers are 0-3. And it's not even necessarily that I think the Pistons have looked so much better than the Pacers, although they have. It's just that they're now three games ahead of the Pacers, and the Pistons had a tough schedule to start. They're 3-0 against it. And even if they play, both these teams play like we thought they were going to play, which I'm not necessarily convinced of based on the start of the year, the Pistons are three games ahead of the Pacers right now.
Yeah, it means a lot, and they are in the same division, so they'll play similar schedules. And yeah, I think the Pistons have looked very good, so that to me factors in. I'm a little bit proud of that because I had them in. It's funny because we had them 8-9 and 9-8, but I'm still puffing my chest a little bit because I'm like, oh, I had them at 8, but still, I'm.
You still feeling good about Milwaukee being out?
I think. I'm pretty happy with them in the 9 spot because for me, how I interpret putting a team in the 9 spot is that assuming somebody falls off, they're going to be in that mix, but then there's still a chance that it's them. You know, it's whoever falls off due to injury, and I'm pretty much okay with that. But mine is in the Eastern Conference too, and it's Toronto. I was critical of Toronto. I still don't love them, but the biggest thing that has been a part of this is that their defense has been where we hoped it would be. I mean, right now, they're 93.8 points per possession, or 93 points per 100 possessions. They're 7th in defense, and while that might be a little bit stronger than they end the season, if they can even be in that, you know, top 10 mix, that makes them a team that's more likely to host a first-round playoff series than not.
Okay, yeah, I think I had them 5th in the East. I feel relatively good about that. And one thing, too, if we're kind of talking about the overall variation over the course of the season, really, you know, probably last year, this is off the top of my head, but last year, the best offense was about 110 points per 100 possessions per NBA.com, and the worst offense was about 97, right? And same thing for the defense, or about pretty similar to that over the course of an entire season. Right now, the worst defense is the Pelicans at 114, and the best defense is the Jazz at 85. So you have almost double the range over this sort of a short sample size as you do a regular season. So we've got a long way to go here, especially strength of schedule is huge. Injuries are huge. But that said, I think there is enough to start to think about this a little bit. And there's been some research that's shown that essentially once you're 20 games in, that's pretty well predictive of kind of what the level of performance is going to be, unless you have some intervening variable such as a trade or an injury or something like that. And, you know, people who have argued against the season being so long have pointed to that basically after 20 games, the outcome of the season, you're pretty close to decided as far as who the good teams are and who the really bad teams are.
So you're saying that if the Lakers are still towards the bottom in defense after 20 games, we should think that they're not going to redeem it?
Yeah, maybe so. But again, this all, when you're looking at this stuff, a lot of it is kind of you're factoring in preseason expectations. I think even projection models would say preseason expectations would still be, you know, probably 90% of a production model at this point. So that still is holding the greatest amount of sway for me right now. But when you look at the fact that for some of these, they're playing right into what we already thought was going to be the case, then you can start to feel a little bit more confidence than when a a team is not fulfilling what I think most people's expectations for them were pregame. Or preseason, rather.
Another one that I'll put out there, this isn't as clear as the Toronto one, because that was the one that really stood out to me, is that I had been of the mind that it was going to take a while for Kristaps Porzingis to really produce, or Porzingis, as they say in the amazing rap video about him. And while I don't think that what he has done so far is totally predictive, that his whole rookie year will be as productive as this, and you know his box score stats are what they are, he's closer than I thought he was, and that is very important.
Yeah, I need to watch some more Knicks. I've only seen that Hawks game. By all accounts, they acquitted themselves well in a 94-84 loss to the Spurs. That's a pretty good defensive performance for a team that has really struggled on this end, and you would have to say doesn't have a ton of defensive talent. So they definitely appear to be playing harder than they did in past years. But, yeah, I would like to see what Porzingis has been doing so far, because, yeah, a lot of the reports on him have been pretty encouraging. I can't wait to see whether I agree with him. All right, so my next preseason prediction to revise is Anthony Davis for Defensive Player of the Year. That I should have thought a little harder about that one. I totally didn't even really think of Kawhi or Draymond, who finished 1-2 last year, and especially when we were considering that I was doing it as who I thought would actually be the best defensive player, as opposed to who would just win it because of whatever the optics are. Yeah, I think it's going to be really, an AD just has not looked good so far. That whole team has not looked good so far. I don't see them getting into being, you know, a top five defense, and it's really hard to vote a guy defensive player of the year if you're not on a top five defense. So I don't know. Who do you think, who is your current favorite? I mean, Gobert has got to be up there, obviously, with how Utah has played defensively so far. So I think my top three right now would be Gobert, Kawhi, and Draymond at this point.
Yeah, that would be my top three. Kawhi is going to get the buzziness just because he does it in a way that I think is a little bit more apparent to people. You know, like you watch that, he had, I don't know if you saw it, he had a really nice block on Carmelo tonight where he basically blocked the ball before it was shot. And he has those types of plays and the steals that he gets. Rudy, I mean, there's a very real chance that he is the best, the linchpin of the probably the second best defensive team in the league, and Draymond, you know, is in there for the exact mix. And what I think could help Draymond this year is that the Warriors could, you know, if they can do it for longer stretches without Andrew Bogut, I think that strengthens his case, even though, you know, Azili has played well defensively, especially tonight. I think that helps it. But to me, those are the three right now. And when you look through, not only are those the top three teams in defensive efficiency right now, a lot of the teams that are in the next group at the moment aren't teams that have a single player that you can point to say, hey, you know, if you can go, oh, well, they were a little bit worse, but this guy was such a huge part of it. And, I mean, I'm sure some people will support DeAndre Jordan just because people always do, but that's a completely separate thing.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, it's funny. Maybe this is the year that Andre Drummond actually becomes on defense what people believe that DeAndre Jordan is.
That's a great point. And something that actually there will be a thing for discussion. Seth Partnow was talking about this today, that DeAndre Jordan might be the player who has the most inverted reputation. Basically, that because he's a great offensive player. He's an elite pick-and-roll finisher, arguably the best alley-oop finisher of all time, and just in terms of the way they use him and everything like that. And his defense is pretty overrated. I mean, he's not terrible on that end, but he's not defensive player of the year caliber. And I can't think of many players who have that duality. And so they're basically the same level of quality that the aggregate fan or media member or whatever thinks they are, but do it succeed in a completely different way.
Yeah, number one offensive RPM center last year, DeAndre Jordan. Yeah, we are remiss actually in not talking about Azili's game.
Oh, yeah.
Tonight. I've noted on a few occasions that Zach Randolph ate him up in the limited time that they were matched up in the playoffs last year. Azili got him back, and as Ethan noted on Twitter, the fact that Zach Randolph shoots every shot with his left hand played in great with the fact that Azili blocks every shot with his right hand. So yeah, he was a monster blocking shots, and more encouragingly, he added that aspect that we talked about on yesterday's program of being able to finish on alley-oops, especially off 2 feet. Bogut can still do it a little bit, but he's kind of get a running start. He'll do it off of 1 foot more often. Azili can just kind of be standing still and finish alley-oops. And I think he had like three or four of those, and he got on the offensive glass as well, which is not something that Bogut does as well. The Warriors really were able to get a lot more second chance points than Memphis as well, and I think that that is something that can be another fearsome aspect of this team when Azili is in there, because they spread you out so much, it's just going to be really tough to get a box out on Azili.
Yeah, because he crashes the boards and he's good at it, and they don't need him in transition defense in that early stage because they have so many other guys. So he can crash the boards with kind of, if you want to call it, reckless abandon, because they have all the other pieces in place. I thought he looked great, and for me, one of the I don't like the term silver linings, but I guess that is a term for it in this circumstance, is that I really wanted to see how he meshed with playing more minutes with the starters, you know, with Draymond, with Klay, because when you're thinking about the center of the future for the Warriors, assuming that Bogut will, you know, that Bogut will age and all that, you know, the way to see that is how he plays with that unit. And so far, you know, it's a small sample size, I acknowledge that, but he's looked very good. He's a different type of player. You know, he does things differently, but he's succeeding.
Yeah, Memphis is a pretty good matchup for him.
Absolutely.
As long as he can guard their guys one-on-one in the post, which he definitely deserves credit for improving on, because they're not going to put him into space the way some other teams are, where he has to make a decision, where he's got to rotate hard on help. He can kind of just camp out in the basket. They're not going to spread you out. And he had some really high awareness plays too. Like, one that really stuck out to me was he was guarding Marc Gasol in the high post, and Zach Randolph was able to get a post up right at the dotted line on Draymond Green. And Azili, as soon as the pass came from Gasol, sprinted back down to double team Zach Randolph, and Randolph was forced to give it up and wasn't able to get a shot. It was really a very nice awareness play by Azili, and something that, you know, he's growing. He's growing, and I think it's hard to tell where that's going to end, but you have to feel better after these last couple performances for him that he could be potentially the starting center to replace Bogut.
And Azili is in a very unusual place with the sport, because he's 26 years old, but he picked up the game incredibly late, and he's missed so much time in his professional career due to injury.
Yeah, that's true too, although I still maintain that I've never seen an indication that guys who pick up the game late progress at any better of a rate in the NBA than other guys do. And so whether they do or don't, I don't know, but I've never seen anything to actually prove that statement, which has sort of been a long-held ideal. All right, that's about it for me. You got anything else before we go?
Do you want to pick players of the night?
Yeah, sure. I didn't pick one, but go for it. I'll pick one.
The guy who stuck out to me, of course we're biased because of the game we attended, but Draymond Green today, I think today encapsulated part of what makes him so special, and that's, you know, his box score stats were his box score stats. He had 11 points, 9 rebounds, and 8 assists. That would have been a triple-double if he'd played the fourth quarter, but he had no need to. But the fact that he can defend Marc Gasol primarily on one end, and then rebound the ball, initiate the offense, and he had a bunch of assists during, he had 6 assists during the second and third quarters when they took the game away, but he gives them a dimension and a value at the power forward position that, while he isn't the best player at that position in the league, that very few players can match.
Yeah, I'll go with Ty Lawson. James Harden did get back on track. He had 37 points on 31 shooting possessions, 12 out of 26 from the field. Wasn't still getting the greatest shots in the world, but at least got to the line his customary 11 times. Ty Lawson, though, had a fantastic night, 14 points and 11 assists. 4 steals for him. He also was only 2 of 7 from the free throw line, so should have scored a little bit more. And he was especially important in keeping the Rockets afloat and helping them actually make up more ground when Harden was out at the end of the third quarter and beginning of the fourth, which is something that they really lacked. You know, whenever Harden went out of the game against the Warriors in the conference finals, for example, like, they just got killed. So it was good to see Lawson get on track and Harden as well. And then my coaching move of the night would be to McHale for just going straight up small all the time against the Thunder and daring those guys, Ibaka and Cantor, to beat them. And they weren't, and I guess to a lesser extent Adams, and they weren't really able to do that. And Billy Donovan, for whatever reason, was a little bit loath to match up small, despite the fact that they have kind of all these wings who should enable them to play some small ball.
Well, yeah, and a lot of people have argued that the Durant at the 4, Ibaka at the 5 lineup is functionally unguardable. So, you know, they have that in their back pocket, but they haven't really used it yet.
Yeah, Anthony Morrow, only 5 minutes in this game, which I saw that there was an explanation for that from Donovan, not injury related, but I didn't have a chance to see what that was yet. But also, DJ Augustin was really bad in this game, too. We should note that. He had 6 turnovers and was a minus 12. It was a big problem when he wasn't able to kind of hold the fort down after Westbrook went out with the foul trouble. But I think of him as a quality backup point guard. I think he'll bounce back from that. I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Sure, and also in case of emergency, they have Cameron Payne. They drafted him in the lottery. In the lottery. And I like him a lot. I think it might take him some time, but he has the potential to be that guy either this year or moving forward.
All right, you got anything to plug at all?
Yes. I have a piece coming out, something that we both will talk about on our respective podcasts in the near future is the extension deadline that just passed. And so I have a piece that is going up for the Sporting News by the time people will have listened to this, kind of explaining the timeline and explaining why so many players did not extend.
Yeah, that's I'm actually going to be talking to Bobby Marks for tomorrow night's episode on that very issue, former assistant GM of the Nets. And actually, if you got some time to kill, my podcast with him back in July should still be pretty green. Might be worth listening to if you like that sort of thing, some like real cap dorkery. He did that stuff for 20 years, basically. So he's a great guy to have on. I have a plug as well. I talked about the Cavs' future and their luxury tax situation, what they might do with the Brendan Haywood trade exception this summer or during the year, and who some potential trade targets could be and how they might improve their team now that they're going to be so capped and taxed out. So that's going to come out Sports Illustrated at the Cauldron probably by the time you've listened to this, so look for that as well. If you would like to support our podcast, which of course we appreciate, you can use the cap space code, all one word, on DraftKings if you want to play some daily fantasy basketball or football, but probably basketball since you're listening to a basketball podcast. Also, the code on SeatGeek is another great partner that we have, CapSpace, to get a free $20 on that. Liking either of our Facebook pages, Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue NBA, respectively. Follow us on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue. Danny LaRue is apparently less common than Nate Duncan is, so he did not have to append the NBA to his Twitter handle. And or an iTunes rating or ranking is also appreciated as well. All right, I've kept you out for too long tonight. We'll talk to you all next time.